Well, welcome to this study of Aurora Consurgents. We'll meet every other Thursday from 12:30 to 2:30. Take a break in about halfway. Those of you who have done this before know we start right on time and end on time. Our last class will be June the 3rd, and then we take the summer off. And then we'll figure out mid-September. After Labor Day sometime we start. I'm guessing we're going to take about 15 to 25 meetings to get through the book. What I like to do is go the pace of the group. That's why I can't give you the exact number of sessions. But I would guess 40 to 50 hours to cover it. And we'll go through it sentence by sentence at points, and sometimes we'll go through kind of quickly. It depends on how dense the material is. Okay, well, let's start off looking at the book Aurora Consurgents and talking about its possible author. We'll spend some time examining how this text came to be, how we reached the conclusion that it belongs to a particular author. If it wasn't written by Thomas Aquinas, which is what it's ascribed to, it's written by somebody like Thomas Aquinas. It's written out of a medieval Christian worldview, which at points you're going to find is not so different from our worldview, in the sense of this breakdown of right and wrong and wanting a sure universe. So, as I said, in a moment we'll talk about how she came to discover the text. But first let's get a sense of either who the author was or the kind of person who might have written this. And that takes us back to page 407. Basically, it's going to be her conjecture that this text is a transcript of the visions of Thomas Aquinas on his deathbed. We'll spend a great deal of time understanding what that all means, but let's first acquaint ourselves with Thomas Aquinas. And we'll start on page 409. She says, "Let's take a moment there. It may be worthwhile, therefore, to scrutinize the life and career of St. Thomas from a psychological point of view." When he was born in southern Italy, 1225, near Naples. When he was five, he was sent, now I'm on page 410, to the monastery at Monte Cassino. Now, Monte Cassino, if you remember any of your church history, was the first monastery, Benedictine. So, right away, he's put into a isolated and rarefied atmosphere, which apparently fit his nature. He was said to have a quiet and taciturn manner. At the age of 19, a little farther down the page, 410, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines up, he joined the Dominican order, so he was a Dominican. To give you a feeling for his personality, his parents were against this. They didn't want to see him a cleric. They wanted to see him involved in the world of politics. So his mother, around 411, sent a courtesan to seduce him. And he went to the fireplace and picked up a burning brand and said, "Get away." And she says there on 4:11, thereafter he abhorred the sight of women. So you see, we're dealing with a very spiritual, a very masculinized, and world distancing personality, which is the classic Christian attitude for that time. If you remember, some of you have heard the work I've done on Ion. As Jung understood the psychological function of Christianity, when Christianity entered the scene, the world was in a mess, and there was the dominance of the decadence of antiquity was threatening human society with destruction. If the Roman era had continued, we just would have blown ourselves up in desire and debauchery. So the psychological effect of Christianity was to introduce what Jung calls a spiritual principle, as opposed to the instinctual principle of the hedonism of late antiquity. And that was a force of equal weight counter to all this libidinous excess. And Jung felt that was a very valid function of Christianity, a very valid psychological function, that it introduced really another principle of experience into human culture. And that gave civilization the power to stand against all of the decadence and hedonism that was Rome. So this man, you see, is heir to that tradition. That's the point I would like to leave you with. He is sort of Mr. Spiritual Christianity. So the visions that we're going to see him having at the end of his life will represent all that unconscious material that version of Christianity has suppressed and repressed. And to the extent that we are still living in the one-sidedness of rationality and spirituality and intellectualized culture into a self-sacrificing morality, all those quote-unquote Christian virtues of the one-sided spiritual sort, we're going to be part of that stream of consciousness as well. So that these visions will be speaking to us also. So I've said this to try to give you a sense of this material's relevance. It sounds like, well, why should I be interested in the visions of a church father, not a church father really, but of a church cleric 800 years ago? Well, because his issues are very similar to ours, we will see. And the material that is going to be assaulting him, and it is really an assault from his unconscious, is the same material that's assaulting us. And they are images of the divine feminine. Because of the masculinized anti-female and anti-feminine bias of his consciousness and of this whole spiritual counterposition of Western Christendom, the feminine is going to play a very big role. So even though we're looking at a medieval text, I hope we can feel as we go along we're looking at something very, very relevant. All these images are applicable to our own growth, our own struggle. And that's why I kind of wanted to give you a sense of who this guy was, where he fits in the history of Christianity, and what that means for us. Some of you will recognize this, some of you won't, but he went to Paris and then to Cologne in the course of his education to study under a guy that Jung quotes all the time, Albertus Magnus. Albertus Magnus was likewise, I believe he was a Dominican. I have to check that. Uh, priest and teacher, who was contained in a Christian tradition, but also had a huge range of interests. He was sort of like the Leonardo da Vinci of this time, mentally. He was very interested in alchemy, and through him, it's thought that Thomas Aquinas acquired some knowledge of alchemy. And as we're going to see, alchemical themes appear in these visions of his. Over to 414. I'm just skimming through this section. Who was Thomas Aquinas? Just to hit the main point, so you get an idea who Thomas Aquinas was, and then where he fits into the big picture. Albertus was an impressive and vital personality with a highly receptive mind. That's 414, beginning of the second paragraph. He had an innate sense for anything new and of value for the future. So he came into contact with the best minds of the time, is the point. How Thomas Aquinas made his living then was, this is the beginning of the period of the rise of the universities. So he was a teacher. And he was a teacher in the tradition of what we call scholasticism. What's scholasticism? Scholasticism is basically the theology of the Middle Ages as it began to be taught in universities. It's really the first systemization of Christian theology. And it is boring as all get out. I'm going to play you a little tape describing how Thomas wrote, just to give you a taste of it. But if you can again place this in its historical context, Christianity was something that was pretty fluid up until this time. But with the rise of the universities and then the training of priests and the continued birth of different orders, Christianity began to be a systematized and standardized way of looking at things, and that is scholasticism. And Thomas Aquinas is the main scholastic figure. And they based a lot of their ideas on Aristotle, trying to show the link between the thought, the rigor of Aristotle's reflections on nature, to the same rigor reflecting on the nature of Catholic Christian theology. Well, let's get a feeling for his person over on 415. I'm going to read you most of that page. Second line down. His biographers extol his quiet gravity, his equable and humble acceptance of the religious rule, and his precocious knowledge. Skip a couple sentences. His resistance to the attempts of his family to lure him back into the world has something almost timorous about it. It betrays his sensitivity, perhaps also a weakness in regard to the sphere of sexuality, which he shunned as menacing and diabolical. His reluctance to appear before the public is further evidence of an introverted disposition. So again, a spiritual, masculinized, introverted, contemplative person. As we'll see, 419, one of the issues we're going to be examining throughout is either Thomas's or whoever it is who had these visions, their relationship to emotions. Because scholasticism was a way of thinking. And it did not take care of the emotional and feeling side of experience. As she says on 419, what we miss, however, is the emotional factor. To what extent did these alleged facts impress themselves on his feelings? And so the feminine imagery that comes barreling down on him at the end of his life is going to be filled with all that emotional dimension which he excluded. Another point she makes on 420, about the middle of the page, that these mendicant orders considered it their task to keep Christianity pure and fight any falling back into Gnostic regression as they would feel it, or otherwise pagan backslidings. God's watchdogs, they were called. To fight, to clarify what is really Christian and what is heretical. Apparently, Thomas was a prolific writer. One biography I read said he would, when he was writing, he would dictate. And he would dictate four different books at the same time. He'd have four different scribes, and he'd dictate part to one, then take a break, the other wrote up, to another, another, another. So he was very, very productive in this period. Now we get drawing closer to the end a little bit. Page 422. Third paragraph. Third line, he had a highly strung personality whose depths were unsuspected and still less understood by the ordinary man. The superb one-sidedness of his conscious thinking alone is enough to guarantee the existence of a totally different inner world, whose task it was to maintain the balance of the personality as a whole. See, that's what we'll be investigating. We'll be investigating that inner world, which is so different from the conscious standpoint of himself and then therefore of Christendom at the time. Reports of ecstasies and other unusual biographical data are indicative of this invisible background. They belong to the phenomenology of an imposing personality filling out the picture on the unconscious side, which generally expresses itself only indirectly. So against that rationality and the clarity that they were seeking to achieve, all those aspects of the human psyche that were ignored are going to reappear in those visions. Or again, if you translate it into our modern idiom, all the parts of the psyche which are not included in the typical worldview of Christendom are going to be in these visions and will be an attempt to balance that out, namely the feminine. he died in twelve seventy-four, and in 1273 he started to manifest a different type of experience. In the middle of Mass one day, he suddenly paused and just stood there as if struck dumb. After the Mass, after he collected himself together, and after the Mass, he went to his writing desk and said to his closest companion, a brother, Reginald, this you find on 425, two, three, five lines down, "Everything I have written seems as worthless as straw." So within a year of his death, he had an experience in which it seemed to him that everything that he had tried to understand was worthless. Now, I think what we can see here is the beginning of that state of mind which is going to lead to division. So all that material that had been building up in him prior to the to this experience came knocking on his door.
And all material he'd been suppressing all his life.
All the material he'd been suppressing came and overturned that meticulously constructed and watertight description of the nature of Christendom. Yeah. January 1274. Bottom of page 426. He was riding from Italy to France. Remember, he was an active teacher going to these various schools. He struck his head on a branch and fell unconscious. He was taken and died shortly thereafter. Taken to bed and died shortly thereafter. And it's thought that it's at this time that these visions occurred. What the biographers have stated is that the students in the place where he was in bed asked him for a final lecture on the Song of Songs. And we'll be talking about the Song of Songs, which is an Old Testament book at great length. It's basically a love story. And this is one of the reasons von Franz is thinking that this text came from him, because it is documented that some of his last minutes were spent lecturing on the Song of Songs, and it plays such a very large role in this text. On his deathbed, he was lecturing. And then died shortly thereafter. That's a very brief overview. Thomas Aquinas, where it fits in church history, why we should care, how that affects us, and what this experience might mean to us, and what we can learn from it. Well, a good summary of what I've been trying to say is in the footnote on page 431. If you go down 1, 2, 3, 4 lines, 5 lines, its content, meaning the visions and his unconscious material, its content was opposed to the spirit of the age. Everyone see that? Mm-hmm. So that's how we're going to be looking at this and why it's so vital. To a certain extent, it's going to be opposed to the spirit of our age. And the main image will be the feminine dimension of the divine, namely Sophia, and we'll talk all about that.
That's in the same paragraph, the last sentence.
It's threatening. It's very, very threatening. I doubt it. And we'll talk a little bit more about how this text came to be, etc. But I'm just had to start somewhere, so I wanted to give you a feeling for who it's thought to belong to, and where it fits in to our history, where it fits into us, what kind of guy he was. Next thing I want to do is going to be very irritating, I have to warn you. But I brought along about 10 minutes. I may not play the whole thing. You may go crazy before the end of 10 minutes. A lecture on scholasticism. Let you hear what it sounds like. Give you a feeling for the way this man thought, and the kind of rationality that the material is attempting to compensate. We aren't that bad as this stuff anymore, but still you can ask yourself, take a look at your own rationality, how we attempt to understand things cognitively only and leave out the emotional dimension. And really, our mental outlook is based on scholasticism. Had there been no scholasticism, there'd be no science. And science has certainly taught us to enter into this logical way of thinking. So here's a lecture apply as much of it as you can stand. I just intercepted it. This is from the teaching company. Let's see if Murphy cooperates here.
Who's giving this lecture?
Jeremy Adams. It's called, it's a their course on Thomas Aquinas.
Well, what I want to talk about now is the sunnahs. The four sunnahs that he composed, the four great ones, although only three of them are large. One is small, but in its own way very great indeed. Now, what was a sunnah? It was a new genre of philosophical writing developed in the mid-12th century, especially in Paris. It's specific to the scholastic mentality. Well, there are three great characteristics to a sunnah, it seems to me. First of all, its comprehensive character. Secondly, a very elaborate logical structure. And thirdly, certain features of language and style. Thomas's great Summa Theologiae, or Summa Theologica, as it used to be called, is divided into parts, questions, and articles. Each article is structured as a unit of dialogue as well as logic, in strict logical order and language. Article 1 of Question 2 of Part 1 is entitled, for example, Whether the Existence of God is Self-Evident, a position held by some famous and authoritative Christian and other theologians. Thomas concludes that the existence of God is not self-evident, and he does so as follows. He begins with three objections to his conclusion, each citing a major authority, John Damascene, Aristotle, and Christ speaking through the Gospel of John. He replies, to the contrary, is the formula saying, on the contrary, and he has here a statement of conviction, a logical statement backed by authority, in this case, two works of Aristotle and Psalm 53. Then comes Thomas's developed answers, in which he says, respondeo quia, I answer that, which is followed by our specifically focused replies to each of the three opening objections. Let's take a look at how that works. Question 2 opens with a kind of a short preface, which I'll get to in a moment, then moves on to the first article, Whether the Existence of God is Self-Evident. And most of these articles have a title that is a question. So this whole work is raising questions and then looking for answers. And the text says, we proceed thus to the first article. Objection 1 says, the existence of God is self-evident because those things are said to be self-evident to us, the knowledge of which exists naturally in us, as we can see in regard to first principles. And the quote is from John Damascene's great work on the Orthodox faith. Damascene, a fascinating Syrian Christian, who, while a very serious Christian leader, was also the wazir of one of the early caliphs of Muslim Damascus. So tolerant was the Muslim faith in those days. And he was also very much an Aristotelian. So for Thomas to cite him is not surprising. Therefore, says Thomas, the existence of God is self-evident. Then comes objection 2. Further, those things are said to be self-evident, which are known as soon as the terms are known, which the philosopher says is true of the first principles of demonstration. The philosopher. This means Aristotle. And what Thomas is quoting here is a passage from Aristotle's work on logic, The Posterior Analytics, Book 1, Section 3, if you want to go into that further. What comes then is a summary of the argument of Anselm. That once you understand what the term God means, then...
That's scholasticism. Very rigorous, very structured, very linear. And of course, completely leaving out the non-rational. Well, that's Thomas on the study guide. I tried to give you a quick summary of what the book's about in the study guide, page 1 under text. This is from page 215. Whereas the first five chapters revolve around the central concept, wisdom, as the spirit or soul of alchemy, in the attempt to enrich it with more and more new images, the seven parables that follow portray in dynamic images a progressive process that is intended to illustrate the course of the alchemical opus. Pardon me? Study guide page 1. First five chapters revolve around a central concept, wisdom as the spirit or soul of alchemy, the attempt to enrich it with more and more new images, the seven parables that follow portray in dynamic images a progressive process that is intended to illustrate the course of the alchemical opus. Now, we'll look at that sentence in more detail. I just wanted to give you a quick preview of the book in that sentence. And what that is telling us is that the main image, which is going to appear in these visions, is the biblical figure of wisdom. We'll talk about that shortly. Wisdom is a feminine figure going back to Greek philosophy and the Old Testament. A feminine component or a feminine partner of God, of Yahweh. And the first, so this is what breaks into, I'm going to say, Thomas's experience in his visions. This image, which represents an emotionally toned experience of the divine leaning towards the feminine. All of these words we'll be defining in great detail as we go along. And it knocks him off his feet. It is absolutely overpowering. Almost destroys him. It's so strong. That's the first five chapters. The rest of the chapters are about the attempts of the visionary, the attempts of Thomas or whoever, to come to grips with this experience. So first you get the experience portrayed, and then follows the attempts of the psyche to make that experience stick. And of course, the process by which the psyche makes things stick is the process that Jung described as the alchemical process. So this text is both a depiction of wisdom and a depiction of what the psyche goes through to make this experience stick in the individual through a series of alchemical transformations. So it's both a study of feminine wisdom and what she means. It's a study of what you have to go through to become wise. And it's an account of the alchemical steps that make that happen. So it's also a book about alchemy. You okay so far? Let's now spend some time talking about wisdom. Everything we do in Jungian psychology is an attempt to understand dreams. All of these vast mythological excursions only are worthwhile in the final analysis if they help us understand what we need to know to comprehend dreams. So, in other words, there are going to be wisdom dreams. Another way to put the value of this course is it will acquaint you with the whole range of wisdom symbolism, the range of what it takes to integrate wisdom. So that when you have wisdom, so when these themes come in your dreams, you can recognize them, and you can know what to do about them. So I thought I'd start off giving you some wisdom dreams. Now, wisdom dreams don't knock on your door and say, "Hi, I'm a wisdom dream." They are always couched in subtleties, such that you could easily miss them. One of the most frequent images of wisdom, and if you can just take this on faith for the moment, it will become clearer as we go along why. One reason being that wisdom, when she appears in Auric Insurgents, appears associated with starlight. So stars are a very frequent image representing wisdom. Before we get into the mythological dimension, let's just try it from common sense. I guess you used to say, when all else fails, try common sense. I would like to try to give you now an experiential sense of what wisdom images look like, why they are wisdom images, what the nature of wisdom is, and then give you some wisdom dreams. Let's just start very naive with the assumption based on a text. I think the text is on page 210, if you care to look at it. This is wisdom. Now I'm reading, this is part of the text of Aurora. This is wisdom, namely Queen of the South, who is said to have come from the East, like unto the morning rising, blah, blah, blah. And she's bearing upon her head the crown of the kingdom, shining with the rays of 12 stars. So wisdom wears a crown of 12 stars. That tells us that star dreams are going to be about wisdom. Now let's try this from the common sense standpoint first, and then we're going to go off into some vast tangents. But if you have a sort of a gut feeling for what we're dealing with, I think it'll be easier to stay on track. Just think of the word I see. That tells us that light is a metaphor for consciousness. I see.
Two words.
I see. Or I'm in the dark. For the contrary. So light symbolizes consciousness in dreams. And most of the time, what we're dealing with is sunlight in the natural world. So sunlight is the typical image for ego consciousness. But stars produce a kind of light too. On a brightly starlit night, you can see quite well. Although, of course, you see differently. So there must be more than one type of understanding. There's an understanding symbolized by the sun, and there's an understanding symbolized by the stars. There's also an understanding symbolized by the moon, but let's hold that for the moment. Now, the interesting thing about stars is that we have always seen them in patterns. From earliest times, the constellations of mythology were seen in the patterns that stars seem to group themselves into. And if we look at the natural mind's use of that idea, the patterns of those stars were representative of the patterns of our fate. Fate. F-A-T-E. So, starlight is more than just an understanding. It's an understanding which is patterned. And that pattern has been seen as the pattern of our fate. So to make this very simple, and believe me, we will make it much more complicated, but I think if we start simple, we're better off. Sophia symbolized by starlight, we can roughly interpret as the pattern of our fate. So the study of auroral convergence, which is the study of Sophia, is also a study of what is fate. Again, we will look at this in great detail. How is it that my life is constituted at birth? As you know, in Jungian psychology, we believe, we work with the assumption, that we are born who we are. And then we don't create ourselves, we discover ourselves. And psychological suffering isn't merely this whole business of repression of instincts or power drives or whatever particular system you care to dwell in. It's finally about our missing the point of our being alive. And the point of our being alive, as far as Jung takes it as a hypothesis, is there from day one. So we fall into psychological suffering, or neurotic condition, to use the jargon, when we very simply become somebody other than who we're supposed to be. And it's one of Jung's hypotheses that the strongest drive in the personality is that reaction which happens to bring you back into who you were meant to be. Or, if you use now our language of the text, to get to know Sophia. So Sophia will represent the pattern of your being, which is there at birth. Unfortunately, it's a little more complicated. Because if you go back to the original metaphor of Sophia as light, Sophia isn't the information of your pattern. Sophia isn't the knowledge of your pattern. Sophia is the knowing of your pattern. Sophia is a living consciousness in yourself that knows who you are. So when you get to know Sophia, you don't get to know facts. You get to know another perceiving consciousness. And just as in a friendship, making a new friend eventually leads to upset, so getting to Sophia, to this active and dynamic knowing of your essence, it leads to a catastrophe. Catastrophe.
Yeah, I think there's always a confusion between wisdom as knowing versus knowing.
We'll look at that shortly. In the Old Testament, it's both. And the way we're going to be working with wisdom is not as knowledge, but as knowing.
Right.
That wisdom is an alive consciousness in yourself, apart from your ego, which we are generally not in touch with. And when you do get in touch with it, it works on you. And we're going to see how it works on a person in the way it worked on Thomas Aquinas. That's why this very benign way of putting it, you discover your real self, is actually a very explosive moment, because it's when your point of view comes into this other point of view, and then there's a chemical reaction. Yeah.
Is that the same thing with destiny? Esther, you were born for such a time as this.
It's very close to destiny. We'll pursue this throughout the whole course. I'm just trying to give you a very crude grasp. We'll want to fine-tune all these things. It's not the same as predestination. It's a potential. It's not an actuality. However, if it is ignored, it has a nasty way of arranging actualities. But it's not to say that this certain course of your life was arranged and you have to submit to these bad, destructive things. No. It's saying that your individuality as a potential is prior to your experience. And as you get to know that, the issue of personal responsibility, personal consciousness, etc., is all, of course, all very important. And responding to this and actualizing this and putting this into effect, that's where all the values of humanistic and Freudian psychology are very important. But the beginning point is a discovery of a new point of view. Well, shall we take five, and then we'll come back? We'll get acquainted. I just wanted to get rolling to get things going. We'll get acquainted, and then we'll pick up, and I'll talk a little bit about wisdom conceptually first to give you some ideas, and then we'll look at some wisdom dreams.